The next matter on this morning's calendar is in re the marriage of Mary Elizabeth Moline versus Daniel Robert Moline. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments this morning. If you would, prior to beginning your oral arguments, please introduce yourself and give us your name and who you represent. And the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is David Gapin. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Daniel Moline. With regard to this case, it was a pretty standard divorce case, 28-year or so marriage. Parties resided in Minnesota. My client was an attorney with Travelers Insurance, had a good income, by no means super high income, but a comfortable income. Ms. Moline was working, I believe, in a school. I don't know if she was working to her full capacity. But parties raised some kids, and then the marriage, as I understand it, fell apart. Mr. Moline met a new love interest who happened to be a Swedish citizen. He wanted to move to Sweden in order to marry her. Eventually, that is what he did. That did play into the divorce negotiation. That was part of the process. Mr. Moline's trial counsel, which was not me, brought a motion to bifurcate the divorce proceeding. He was trying to get Mr. Moline divorced so that he could move forward with the Swedish citizenship process. The bifurcation motion, as I understand it, based upon the record, was denied. The parties then appeared for, the matter was set for a trial in July of 2017. The parties were able to reach a stipulation at that time. The stipulation was accepted by the court. It was a pretty standard division of assets, and there was an agreement on spousal maintenance. The agreement on spousal maintenance, however, was not a standard spousal maintenance agreement. If the court looks at the transcript from that hearing, there was a discussion of it. The agreement, essentially, as I understand it, Mr. Moline was trying to get divorced. He wanted to be divorced to move forward with his move. And so he agreed to the entry of a spousal maintenance order, which was appropriate based upon the circumstances at the time. However, the parties agreed to kick the evidentiary hearing down the road. And the transcript reflects that was an essential term of the agreement that there be an evidentiary hearing when Mr. Moline brought a modification request, depending upon what the circumstances looked like after he had completed the move.
And the court did schedule an evidentiary hearing, isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The record is not
to his motion to modify.
Yes, the record, unfortunately, and where the court went wrong and where the error was committed was at that March 21st, 2018 hearing, where initially, and I don't understand why Mr. Moline's trial counsel did this, he filed a motion and didn't mention an evidentiary hearing. Subsequently, he withdrew, and then Mr. Bannis, on behalf of his client, sent a letter to the court saying, it's our understanding that this would be an evidentiary hearing. Court sent out notice that said this was scheduled as an evidentiary hearing, but there's no record as to why Mr. Moline did not appear at that evidentiary hearing. Mr. Williams came back on board, I think, the morning of that hearing and appeared on behalf of Mr. Moline, who was not present and did not appear by phone.
Well, is there anything in this record that indicates that Mr. Moline did not hire Mr. Williams or did not authorize Mr. Williams to represent him at this hearing?
There is not, Your Honor, and that's the problem, is there is no record. And the case law
says that isn't really a problem. He represented him and waived the evidentiary hearing. Judge Houghton's position in her question is, are you suggesting somehow he didn't have authority to do that? And why
was I am suggesting that, yes.
Why wasn't that developed down below, and why are we talking about that now? Are you saying he didn't have authorization?
I don't, there's no record that he had that authorization. There's no reason, and as the case law that is cited, I mean, if the court looks at the trial, the initial hearing transcript, that agreement was contingent upon an evidentiary hearing.
And we understand that, but I'm just putting myself as a former district court judge in the position. We know that the person, the attorney who represented Mr. Moline, entered into this agreement in the first place. He comes back. He's a representative of the court. He says, "Here's my certificate. I am now representing him." What authority is there for the court to contest whether he has that authority or not?
I think it's
if in fact he had been, you know, based on these circumstances, he knew he'd been the attorney, and he knew that the court had settled or had scheduled this evidentiary hearing.
I think it's the court's obligation to make sure that there is a correct and sufficient record of a waiver.
Make that argument to the court. You didn't bring up with the district court. At least I don't understand that you brought up with the district court that the waiver, that there was not a waiver, or that the attorney didn't have the ability to speak on behalf of your client. Did you? Are you just bringing that to us?
I have not appeared in the district court in this matter.
You're saying that the district court, sua sponte, should have kept an eye on that, made that decision.
Yes, based upon the Thompson and the Adams case.
But did you argue that to the district court?
I guess the question is, how would that be argued to the district court? A motion for reconsideration or a motion for amended findings? I don't believe that those are
the mechanism you thought, but I don't know how we can look at that for the first time and in whether the attorney's representation is valid and binding. I mean, that's kind of the issue you're raising, is whether or not the attorney has the authority to bind a client.
That is. And I think the court may be suggesting that the new counsel, my office, should have brought a motion for reconsideration or a motion for amended findings or something post-order. I don't believe that that is a prerequisite for appellate review as to whether errors were made.
Well, let's just say we disagree with you and think it's not properly before us, that argument. It's not developed in the briefs. It's not developed down below. From our perspective, your client was bound by the attorney's waiver of the evidentiary hearing, at least at this point. And you are well into your time, so you may want to get into the other arguments.
Okay. In terms of the other arguments, I've covered the waiver argument, and I do think that it's a procedural right, and I think it takes more than an attorney appearing and saying, we're going to just do this on pleadings instead of an evidentiary hearing. I think there needs to be a record made, and the client needs to be sworn, and he needs to specifically and intentionally, according to the case law, waive his right to an evidentiary hearing, especially since it was an integral part of the agreement.
Okay, let's go right to that. Where is the authority that requires a judge to sua sponte question the authority of any attorney who appears with a certificate of representation on behalf of a client? Where is that authority?
The case law it's the Thompson case and the Adams case.
And what in those cases supports your position here?
It's an integral right of the party. It's not a right of the attorney. The party has to be made aware of it. So with respect to the ultimate order, the district court committed an error of law in holding Mr. Moline to a higher standard. Basically, the cases cited in the order that was issued, the Jonaja, the Claybaugh, the Weiss cases, basically, she implied that because Mr. Moline had entered into a stipulation, it was more difficult for him to get to a modification. Those cases, as discussed in my brief, are inapplicable. The Jonaja case was an obligor who had significantly increased his income, and the recipient was looking to get additional maintenance from him. And basically, the case says, When the maintenance is an integral term of the overall agreement, then it is more difficult to change it. That's not applicable to this case, where the parties specifically agreed with respect to maintenance that it would be revisited in the future. The parties had to understand that it would be something that was going to be brought back to the court. It was
by
not
revisiting it, though, we have a district court finding that your client, husband's intent, his career change was not made in good faith. And everything that you're saying in terms of reevaluation may be true, but we have a district court saying that he quit his job to be free of spousal maintenance to marry and move to Sweden.
Right. And once again, the record is not sufficient to make those findings. It basically bad faith.
It was not made in good faith. That's a credibility determination.
Correct.
And consider that a finding.
And Mr. Moline was not there to give testimony as to his reason for quitting his job and moving to Sweden. The case law, the Hemmingson and Richard case.
He have to show that it was in good faith? Wouldn't it be his burden? He's the one that wants to have maintenance terminated or reduced.
Correct, which is why the court needed an evidentiary hearing in order for him to be able to meet burden.
But the court had his affidavit, right?
The court did have his affidavit, yes. But
okay,
I don't
counsel,
think that.
But let's go back for a minute. If we feel that he did waive his right to evidentiary hearing, then the court has the affidavits, as Judge Hooten was suggesting. And we have a gentleman who quit his job, a well-paying job, and moved to Sweden. Made that major life change and married and moved to another country without any assurance of being employed and almost guaranteed perhaps not getting the kind of income he got here, given that it was not clear that he would get employed when he went there. So there's a substantial change in circumstance brought in by him, by his actions. So now we're left with is whether the change makes the maintenance award unreasonable and unfair. And the court decided in reviewing the affidavits and reviewing the file and reviewing everything before it that your client made his decision for himself and that he did not act in good faith when he quit his employment and moved to Sweden and cut off maintenance. Why is that in error?
The bad faith determination under the Richard case and the Hemmingson case has to be that it's bad in order to impute income for maintenance purposes, that the change of circumstances that the obligor has brought on is for the specific purpose of limiting his income so as to get out of paying spousal maintenance. Now, Mr. Moline did not move for the specific purpose of avoiding paying spousal maintenance, and he made efforts to find employment that's commensurate with what he was making. He asked to have his job transferred. He applied for many, many, many jobs and was unable to come up with commensurate earnings. And so that information regarding those are the baseline circumstances that the court was supposed to look at in the future pursuant to the agreement. And so there are other reasons that a person, an obligor, can make a change of circumstances that don't rise to the level of bad faith for the purpose of modifying a maintenance obligation. And so that's what the court had to look at. And under the case law, there has to be findings and there has to be an opportunity for the obligor to present. And the court needs to assess his credibility on that because it is a subjective determination. It's whatever subjective reasons.
Can't the court assess credibility based upon the circumstances and the affidavits submitted by the parties?
I think it's very difficult for a district court to do that.
Doesn't the law allow the court to do that?
Are
you saying that the district court can never make credibility determinations based on affidavits?
I'm not saying that, no, because I don't believe that a bright line rule like that is appropriate, but I do believe that there is plenty of case law to support that live testimony, that's why we have the right of cross-examination, is much more effective at assessing credibility.
What did you proffer in your affidavit, if anything at all, to show that he was in need of leaving other than to be with his current spouse? That's what the district court hinged on, is that you haven't shown me anything. He wants to be with her. That's your burden hasn't been. You're not saying, gee, I have medical treatments that I need to take. I have elderly parents I need to take care of, or she does. Was there anything at all in your affidavit that indicated anything besides the fact he was getting married and moving?
I guess it comes down to a policy decision about whether this court believes that it is appropriate to prevent a person after a divorce from remarrying.
Well, he wasn't prevented. He chose to move.
Well, she wasn't going to move here. And that was in the affidavit. And so I think there are circumstances that he could have testified to, and she could have testified to, as to why that is. And then the court could have addressed that in the subject of intent. And I do think, and it's addressed in my brief, that the right to remarry is a protected right and should be accorded deference by this court and should be tread lightly upon. I'm not saying that the court can't prevent a party after a divorce from getting married, but effectively, that is a decision that is not to be taken lightly and should have been done after a full evidentiary hearing, and it's unfortunate and problematic that it wasn't. This court can correct that error by remanding it. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chris Bannis. I represent the respondent in this appeal, who was the petitioner at the district court level. It is respondent's position that the district court acted appropriately in all phases of this post-decree motion, which was heard in March of 2018. The issues raised on appeal by the appellant seem to stem from one issue that an evidentiary hearing ended up not being had. Now, appellant's brief suggests that the district court refused or denied Mr. Moline the right to an evidentiary hearing. This simply did not happen.
Can I ask you this? Is there anything in this record that indicates that Mr. Williams, the attorney, did not have authority to act on behalf of Mr. Moline?
There's nothing in the record, nothing. Nor was there any discussion.
Thank you.
The district court was ready for an evidentiary hearing that day. As discussed earlier, but I want to expand a bit, appellant knew full well that this was to be, upon a motion for maintenance, this was to be converted into an evidentiary hearing. Appellant knew this in July of 2017 when he negotiated the terms and signed the stipulated decree. He knew this when his attorney, on the record in July of 2017, expanded in open court on the record the importance of the evidentiary hearing and his own client's need for the evidentiary hearing in terms of entering into this agreement. He additionally knew that this was to be an evidentiary hearing when I sent a letter to the district court on January 29th of 2018, reaffirming and asking the court to make sure that this was heard as an evidentiary hearing. The district court then responded by sending notice just a few days later that this, in fact, was an evidentiary hearing. The discussion of waiver, I think, is clear. This was an effective waiver by counsel on appellant's behalf of the evidentiary hearing. In fact, my words in open court with counsel present talked specifically, in lieu of continuing this matter out for an evidentiary hearing, we have reached the following agreements, to which appellant's counsel affirmed by using the word correct when inquired of the court.
Was the agreement also to that each party then would submit proposed findings?
Yes, Your Honor. And that agreement specifically set a deadline date of April 6th of 2018. And both myself and appellant's counsel did make proposed findings and submissions on that date. It is important to state and point out that at no time on March 21st, 2018, on April 6th, 2018, or any time thereafter, did appellant himself or his attorney raise the issue of his attorney not having the authority to enter into this agreement. In addition, At no time after the June 2018 order was issued by the district court was a motion for amended findings or any request for reconsideration made, raising a claim of, I didn't give my attorney the authority to enter into this agreement. In summary on that issue, this was an effective waiver of the evidentiary hearing, and I believe that the record supports it very clearly. Now, with respect to the actual order of June 2018, it is my position that the district court properly evaluated the issue of the spousal maintenance obligation. By entering into the agreement in March of 2018, appellant agreed to limit the record for the court's review. And that record for the court's review were the filings already on file with the court, Mr. Moline's affidavit, Ms. Moline's counter-affidavit, and all the exhibits that followed and that were attached to that affidavit. The district court was detailed in its findings addressing the change of circumstances and the issue of no good faith. The district court, even though it had a limited record because there was no evidentiary hearing, what was in the record was a value of information in appellant's own words through his affidavit. Appellant, in his own affidavit and his submissions and in the record, acknowledged very clearly that he voluntarily quit Travelers. He quit Travelers by email on December 7th, 2017, with a quit date of December 8th, 2017. And the district court references that in the order. All the other findings with respect to his employment, his intention, his subsequent income, and lack of good faith were detailed in the order and I submit are sufficient enough to withstand appellate review. As to the issue of attorney's fees, there is a claim by appellant that the court did not effectively address the issue of attorney's fees in awarding the $5,000 need and conduct-based. To that, I submit that the court did in fact make sufficient findings. The case law is clear that specific findings on a need-based claim are not fatal if the order reasonably implies that the district court considered the financials and that the district court was familiar with the history of the case. I must remind the court that this motion for modification was just over 5 months after the decree was issued. The district court judge that presided on March 21st, 2018 was the very same judge that presided on this case in July of 2017. This judge was very familiar. And this judge, in her order of June of 2018, did reference the party's financial circumstances and had access to the party's financial circumstances, access from the decree and access from the subsequent submissions by affidavit. Your Honors, this is a short argument. I have nothing further unless the court has questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Since there was a question regarding case law and authority regarding the waiver, I did refer to my brief. It's the Adam versus Adam case cited in the brief, specifically quoted, although neither party objected to the submission on the issue of the issue on the basis of opposing affidavits and arguments of counsel, this did not constitute a waiver of the right to an evidentiary hearing. So in that case, the parties were present and they specifically agreed to it, and the Court of Appeals said, no, that's not a sufficient waiver. And that Adam court went on to say, although waiver may be found by implication, Hummel indicates that it will not be implied simply from participation in the deficient procedures. So the follow-up submission of proposed findings is deficient because the evidentiary hearing was required, and it cannot be therefore implied from that Mr. Moline somehow waived it. The court, I'm sure, is very familiar with taking stipulations we'll swear the party, the standard process is to swear the parties in, have the attorneys inquire, and have the parties affirm on the record that they understand the right that they are waiving. That was not done here. It is unfortunate. I believe that Mr. Moline was a contributing factor to that. But I don't believe that this court, on this record, can affirm it because of that error. With respect to whether the court was ready for an evidentiary hearing on March 21st, 2018, I don't believe the record is clear on that, because specifically in the transcript, the judge said, rather than continuing this matter out for an evidentiary hearing, we're going to do written submissions. And so the alternative to the written submissions.
Can I just stop you there? Because I'm looking at the court's order, and it said respondent failed to appear at the evidentiary hearing for his own motion. It was agreed that the court would rule on the pleadings already submitted.
And the record, unfortunately, isn't clear that respondent was made aware that failure. Normally, if there's a default, there has to be at least a notice that if you don't show up for this hearing, you will be held in default. The substantive relief against you will be granted. The transcript supports that the judge thought, well, if he doesn't show up, we'll continue this out for the evidentiary hearing. But Mr. Williams, whether he had the authority or not, said, no, let's just submit this on proposed findings.
Counsel, your client was a lawyer.
Yes.
So, I mean, some of this
doesn't mean he should be held.
I understand, but I mean, lawyers are generally very careful about hearings, that they're particularly when they're personally involved in them. So,
correct. And I didn't represent him at the time, and I don't know what considerations went into that. And unfortunately, this record is not sufficient to show that.
So we don't know if he was in the country at the time. Was he in Sweden at the time?
On this record, I couldn't tell you. With respect to the attorney's fees, the court called it conduct and need-based attorney's fees. However, I didn't address conduct because there was no specific conduct identified by the court that unreasonably contributed to the length and expense of this proceeding. And the court has to make a specific finding as to this was what made the dragged the proceeding out. There was no such finding, so the court can't make a conduct-based attorney's fees. The findings were need-based, and they were very conclusory in nature, saying, well, at the time of the divorce, he had a higher income. But there wasn't any real finding on Ms. Moline's need. There were other assets that she was awarded in terms of the retirement accounts, in terms of house proceeds. There were other things. And the court should specifically make findings that, you know, she doesn't have the resources to pay her own attorney's fees based upon the circumstances that existed at the time of the hearing, the March 2018 hearing, and not the July of 2017 hearing. And so I think the findings are very conclusory, and the case law says if it's just conclusory findings, that's not sufficient for an award of attorney's fees. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within 90 days. Thank you.